Let's get our Bibles and turn to Psalm 120. So Psalm 120, and tonight we'll start a new series that we'll be in for several weeks. The title is, of course, if you're taking notes, the Psalms of Ascents, which we'll look at in a few minutes, an overview of them. If you have the handout, you don't have to use it. I really won't refer to it except for tonight, and I'll probably touch on it one more time next week. We'll use it tonight mostly just sort of as a broad overview, mainly because I want you to know that these psalms are a collection of psalms, and it'll help you as we go through, not so much tonight's, but some of the other ones. But we'll look at that in just a minute. So what we'll do is I'm going to do an overview of the handout, which will kind of give you an overview of the series. If you want to use this, there's a spot for notes. You don't have to if you use your own, but in any case, you can if you want to. And then we'll look at Psalm 120 itself. And one of the things you'll notice with these psalms is they're particularly short. And so some of the psalms we'll just study by themselves. In other words, I'll just do one. Some weeks I'll probably do two because they're so short. Some of them have four or five verses, so it just depends. So we'll look at that outline, or the handout, excuse me. I'll give you the outline for Psalm 120, which is the only one we'll look at tonight. And then I'll leave some time for questions, answers, discussion, and those sorts of things we'll have for the end. But if you take the handout, let's take a few minutes to do an overview of the Psalms of Ascents. And I think it'll help a little bit have an idea, because sometimes people just think, well, the Psalms are just these random poems and somebody just accumulated 150 of them, but that's not the case. Sometimes they are just sort of standalone. Sometimes they're collections of topics and themes and such. Now, Psalms 120 through 134 are called the Psalms of Ascents. And in case you think I made that up, if you look at Psalm 120, I can't describe every single variation of the wording, but it's going to have something, probably, most likely. Most Bibles are going to say a song of ascents or something similar to that. And if you go through Psalm 120, starting there, and you go through Psalm 134, you'll see all of them have that, if you will, subscript. It'll have the title of it, whatever the translation calls the title of the sermon, or the psalm, excuse me, and then it'll have that. So this is a collection of 15 psalms. They go by some variation of names. They're all very similar. Songs of ascents. It's not ascend, by the way. It's ascents. And sometimes it's referred to as pilgrim psalms. I have that on there for you. Some people refer to it as song of degrees. All of it has to do with a variation of the word, of course, ascents. Okay? So it could be ascents if you think of steps or degrees. Just depends on the translator, depends on who's explaining it, but they're all sort of synonymous. That makes sense? It's just, it depends on the translation, but they'll more likely than not say a song of ascents or a close variation. And so these are Psalms 120 through 134. And these are great devotion type psalms, not that the other ones aren't, but you'll notice just how short they are. For example, if you look at Psalm 123, it's only four verses. So on some of these, we'll do two a night, but not for tonight. Now, if you look at who's the author of these, I mentioned this is just basic information. Some of it will help us later on when we interpret it to give us a general idea of when it was occurring. David wrote four, Solomon wrote one, and some man named Anonymous wrote 10. No, don't write that down. That's not anonymous, is that in the sense, obviously, that we don't know who it is. I mention that again because sometimes, I don't know if you ever heard someone say, David wrote the Psalms, some of them, but again, not all of them, okay? So just make note of that. The anonymous Psalms we'll go through here. For instance, if you look at tonight's, if you look at next week's, you'll see the same thing. So why are these collected, and why are they called, for instance, the Pilgrim Psalms, which is typical what you would have someone use that. It's a good way to think of it. If you look at the note there, I have it there, verse 5, and then we're going to read the note from the Ryrie Study Bible. He does a good job of concisely stating them. But basically, just remember at this point, if you're not familiar with them, these songs or psalms were sung when people were making their way to Jerusalem. Okay, so this is just an example. Okay, the Israelites were dispersed, and when they would make their journey to celebrate various feasts, we'll say Passover, for example, they might sing these songs, these psalms, on the way to Jerusalem. Okay, notice the way Ryrie has it in the Ryrie Study Bible. He does a good job here. He says, quote, this is number 6 on the handout. Ryrie says, a song of ascents, Psalms 120 through 134, formed a hymn book used by pilgrims going up to Jerusalem for the annual feast of Passover, Pentecost, and Booths. It's a good, concise description of what these are. So what he's describing here, Ryrie, is simply an Israelite who's making his way up to Jerusalem various times in their history, and they would sing these on the way there. I won't read number 7. It's just a variation of the same thing. And so that's the idea. So don't get confused here with pilgrims. I know we live in the United States. That's not what we're talking about, okay? So just make sure we don't get confused. It's just a way to describe people making a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, okay? So these are psalms for Israelites, and I'll touch on this in a few minutes, how it relates to us. But you'll notice B here. Now, this is entirely me, and this is just a way to sort of give you a bird's eye view of these collections, or as Ryrie sometimes, and some people call them a book, a collection of psalms. If you'll notice here, I just call it a keyword. Now, if you read these and you say, well, Pastor, I don't like deliverance, I like deliverer. Well, that's fine, okay? If I don't like security, I like guardian. This is just my way of you getting a glimpse of sort of a theme or what the point is, okay? There's other pieces to it. So, for instance, if you look at each one of these, I put some keyword next to it just to sort of jog in your mind what they mean. So, for instance, tonight, deliverance. Well, there's a few ways you could vary that. Basically, what you'll find is the very first one, the psalmist wants to be delivered from liars and people who stir up trouble and are hostile, okay? And so he goes to whom? The deliverer in his view, which is God. So deliverance is sort of the main idea, okay? Next week, if you look at the next one, is security is just the word that I use. You could probably use guardian. An example would be this. If you want to read ahead for next week, if the Lord can keep an entire nation safe, can he keep one person safe? It's sort of obvious, right? Because if he can't take care of one, he can't take care of many. If he can take care of many, he can take care of one. And so that's just sort of what these key ones are. You could use some other ones, but I'm just using these just to give you an idea of what the theme is. But of course, the natural question that Christians have is, okay, so if these were written to Israelites and Jews, and they made their pilgrimage to Israel, okay, that makes sense for them to sing them, but we don't need them because we can't learn anything from them. That might be what someone may be thinking, okay? So if these were written to Israelites, is there any applicability, or how can we relate to them today? Let's look at, I gave you 3 sort of summaries. And you'll see there in letter C, I'm going to read the second and third one because the first and the second are very similar. But before I do that, would someone read for me 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11? If someone would do that for me. Because I want you to understand them, because these are psalms that were written for Israelites, in other words, Jews. However, we can learn lessons from them. And there's a difference between learning a lesson and sort of reading yourself into the text. We want to grab the truths from it, and that's what we'll do. But this is a helpful one, but someone reads 1 Peter 2:11 for me. Doesn't matter who.
I got it.
Okay, you go ahead, Don.
Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul.
That's fine. So Peter is writing to Christians. What does he call them? Pilgrims. You and I are, and we'll see this later on in time, you and I are pilgrims. In other words, is earth our eternal destiny? No, our true home is in heaven. Okay, so all you see there is that Peter's stating that we are sojourners, we're strangers in this world. I think it's funny, Christians want to be at home here, and we're never going to, okay? So having read the verse, look at the quote that I have under C on the handout, and I'm going to read it. The first two basically say the same thing, but I'm just going to read this second one. It's probably a little bit more clear by R. Lee Harlow, and this is on his Psalms commentary. He says, Christians are not at home in this world. We are like strangers. Notice 1 Peter 2:11. That's what we just read. We are on our way home to the Father in heaven, and we can use these, it should be songs, is a typo on my end, these songs of ascents to praise God. The point is, I want you to see is, as we go through these, we can grab the principles and the truths that were written for the Israelites, and we can apply them to our own day. This last one, before we look at Psalm 120, comes from Mike Stollard. I don't know if any of you know him. He's from Friends of Israel, as one of their Bible teachers. He has another good, and this is an example we're going to touch on because one of the Psalms deals with this. Notice what Stollard writes. He says, although these songs were written from Israel, believers today can benefit from them and can certainly join in the plea to, notice, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, a prayer that has validity even today. This is where we get for pray for the peace of Israel, right? Jerusalem, this is the collection. This is where one of those psalms come from. So all I want you to see is the way that these relate is we'll grab the truths from it. But then we'll also see, I mean, should we not be praying for the peace of Jerusalem? I mean, that's not relevant today, is it? Oh, sure it is. So there again, that's why I use that one as an example. So any questions on them at this point, other than what I've gone over? Any questions, anything I need to clarify? Like I said, I'll touch on this one more time next week to make sure we're clear. You don't necessarily have to use it, but should give you an idea of what these are, and I think it helps a little bit with interpretation on a few of them. But let me give you the outline. We're going to look at Psalm 120. This is the first one. Next week we'll look at Psalm 121 and then go from there. I'm going to combine a few of these later on because they're so short. But in terms of Psalm 120, this is the first of the psalms or songs of ascents. What we'll do is I'm going to have someone read the seven verses, but then we'll look at verses 1 and 2, deliverance from lying lips. So if you like, I know some of you like to take notes or follow in an outline. Verses 1 and 2, deliverance from lying lips. If that wasn't ever relevant today, huh? Mm-hmm. So that's verses 1 and 2. And then we'll look at destruction of liars. This isn't an imprecatory, although it almost seems like one. Imprecatory psalm, but that's verses 3 and 4, destruction of liars. And then verses 5 and 7, so again, these are very brief, desiring peace in conflict. So verses 1 and 2, when we read it, the psalmist is going to be praying to the Lord to deliver him from being around lying lips, in other words, slander and those sorts of things. Then, in verses 3 and 4, he's going to appeal, in a sense, and say that he hopes that these liars are destroyed, and he's going to appeal to God to do it. And then in verses 5 and 7, he's going to be picturing a desire for God's people to be peaceful in a world that isn't peaceful, would be another way to say it. I mean, is our world peaceful today? Do people who aren't God's people? I mean, I'll just leave this, and you could take it for what it's worth. Even God's people aren't always peaceful, are they? Okay? So that's sort of the flow of it. But I'll need somebody who's adventurous to read all seven verses, other than Dave, because Dave's resting tonight. He's not allowed to read. He's not allowed to read doctor's orders. But what's up? You could do it, Connie. Go ahead.
In my trouble, I cried to the Lord, and he answered me. Deliver my soul. I am for peace. But when I speak, they are for war.
Okay. Thank you, Connie. All right. So let's start off with, like I said, the way I have it outlined, deliverance from lying lips. So the psalmist here is picturing that he lives among liars and those who are hostile, and he describes that as, in other words, wanting and desiring war, and he is seeking peace. And so in his distress, where does he turn? He turns to the Lord. Okay? So if you notice in verses 1 and 2 when Connie was reading it, he says, "In my trouble I cried to L-O-R-D." All caps, what does that refer to? Is that a casual reference to God, or is that what? Right, so he's calling on the divine name there. That's all caps. That is Jehovah, Yahweh, I Am. Next week we'll see it is the Creator and the Sustainer. That's where he goes. The very first place he goes in the time of trouble is to go to the Lord. And we all do that, don't we? Our first reaction is to go to the Lord, isn't it? It should
not
be.
Always, but it should,
should be.
Be,
yes. So as I was kind of flippantly saying, it should be, but it isn't. So it's a good reminder. So the very first place he turns in this time of trouble is to the Lord. But it's interesting something, and then we're going to look at an example of this. It says, of course, that he was assured that the Lord would do what he wanted or just hear an answer. He said he would hear him, right? In other words, it implies that he heard because he answers. Now, that doesn't mean that he answers the way that he wanted. Have you ever prayed to the Lord and he's actually answered you, but it's in a way that maybe was different than what you asked? And then you go back and you pray again and you say, "Lord, are you sure you heard me right?" No, but I'm picking. But the idea there is interesting, isn't it? So in his stress and in his trouble and time of trouble, he knows that he can go to the divine God, in other words, Yahweh, I Am, because God will answer him, not how he wants. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But the fact that he answers implies that he hears. So when you pray, you know God will hear. Just depends on what the answer may be. Let me show you an example of this. I'll actually read it. It's in Jonah, and you think, why in the world would you go to Jonah? Look at Jonah chapter 2. I'll just read it. Jonah chapter 2, of course, one of the minor prophets right after Obadiah, if you can find that. But Jonah, if you know, you probably know chapter 2 or chapter 1 pretty well. You remember Jonah says, "I need you to go to Nineveh to preach to the people." And he says, "Nope." And so he heads towards, we think, Spain. Fast forward the story. He gets on a boat. And, of course, he eventually ends up where? Not just in the water, but where? In the belly. Okay. So let me read verses 1 and 2, and you'll just notice the similarities all I'm pointing out. So this is Jonah. He's been swallowed by the great fish. Verse 17, chapter 2, verse 1. "Then Jonah prayed to the Lord," all caps there, notice, "his God, from the stomach of the fish. And he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. I cried for help from the depth of Sheol," in other words, the grave, "and you heard my voice." So when you look at that, what would be the obvious thing? If the Lord can hear in the belly of a fish, he can hear you and I sitting here, can't he? And in other words, it's sort of poetic language in a sense to say there's no barriers between you and I and God. We can go to pray to him, okay? Now, I know someone's going to say, what about sin? Yeah, but you confess sin and that barrier is gone, okay? You can go to God either way. If you're a sinner, you can go to him. If you just need to cry out to him for help, you can go to him. But remember, contrary to what people will say today, he's only saying God will answer, he hears, not that he's going to do what you want. We have this idea in Christianity, I think, today, that God is the one who, in other words, works for us. It's the other way around, okay? We ask God, he may, and oftentimes he does, but he doesn't always do that. Let's go back to the psalm. I was just using that Jonah one as an example, because if God can hear from the belly of a fish, he can hear you from your wherever you are, okay? That's sort of the idea. But we need to understand here, what is his request? His meaning the psalmist. So go back to verse 2. And he wants deliverance. Remember, I told you that was where I came up with the word for the psalm, just a way to remember it. You don't have to. Deliverance from what? Lying, tongues, slander, and such and so forth. The word deliverance is a Hebrew word, nestal, and it means to deliver oneself, to escape, or to be taken away from. So in other words, he wants to be removed from liars, and that's going to be hard, isn't it? Because the world is full of them, isn't it? Okay, and these types of things. How does God feel about liars? It's interesting that there's a lot on it. Someone read for me Proverbs 12:22, and then we'll move in just a second to the next part. But Proverbs 12:22, lying isn't anything new, but God's view on it has not changed, contrary to popular demand. Proverbs 12:22. I'll just read it for time's sake. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal faithfully are His delight. So you have the contrast. Would you rather have the Lord delight in you, or would you rather Him look on you and say, not that He's displeased, but an abomination? I mean, goodness gracious. I like the Believer's Bible commentary. It says, God hates liars. He just doesn't tap dance around it. It says, how careful we should be about not shading the truth, white lies, exaggerations, and half-truths. Who's guilty? So we've all probably been victim of it, though, right? Which is the other side. That's really the side he's looking at. The psalmist has been victim to lies and slander. But what does he do? Goes to the Lord. That implies he trusts God. He knows that the Lord will take care of it instead of taking it into our own hands. I have found this to be a trait. I don't know if it's a cultural, I don't know what it is, but I see this even in Christians. We take matters into our own hands way too often, don't we? We need to go to the Lord and leave it. Now, in case you were wondering, though, if you notice in verses 3 and 4 when Connie was reading it, so he's brought his concerns to the Lord, but now he's going to the psalmist in the sense sort of address this complaint. Like he's going to, in other words, almost like an imprecatory psalm. Imprecatory psalms are those ones where David, for instance, says, just wipe them all out. Of course, he's not doing that. He's going to God, letting God know how he feels. But notice verses 3 and 4, and you'll see the destruction here. It's just what I call it, destruction of liars. He says, what shall be given to you, and what more shall be done to you? So he's addressing the deceitful tongue, those who are lying and slandering. He's trust that God will act. He has to wait, but what will be done? It's interesting the way that he's describing. Now, again, remember, poetic language is just that. It's poetic. And one of the ways in which he describes God as a warrior, and the warrior here, if you notice verse 4, what does the warrior send forth? It, like or as? Sharp arrows and burning coals. That's pretty strong language, isn't it? Now, this one isn't typically seen as an imprecatory psalm, but it gives that sort of idea. If you don't know what I'm talking about, an imprecatory psalm is a psalm where, for instance, David goes and says, wipe out all my enemies, Lord. David doesn't act upon it. He's going to the Lord and leaving it to Him. Have you ever been mad about something and wanted to act out on it? Well, instead of doing that, the idea is to go to the Lord and leave it there with Him. And here, the psalmist is so sure, he is liking in the attacks of the Lord as a warrior who goes forth with these sharp arrows and burning coals. Thomas Constable puts it this way. He says, the Lord would destroy him, meaning the liar, like a warrior who shot arrows at an enemy, or like a flame of fire devouring, a dry broom tree. So the Lord in His time, do you know what He's going to do to liars? He's going to bring judgment on them, isn't He? He's going to bring judgment on the tongue of all men one day. And I think the all men is important because it's not just the unbeliever. You and I are held accountable too for our speech and the way things are. But in this case, have you ever had, and I don't want you to raise your hand because I know what the answer would be. Have you ever been slandered or lied about? The tendency is to what? React back, right?
Amen.
We need to go to the Lord, give it to Him, trust that He will go forward and take forth with vengeance. I will tell you, as a pastor, I have been lied about before, and God has done it. God has dealt with it, but not always right away. Do you understand? I think that what is happening with the church is we've allowed the culture and the news and all the politics to allow us to do what? To attack, right? And we aren't supposed to be that way. In case you think, maybe God says, well, under slander or lie, you can attack. Notice how the psalm ends, though. It's verses 5 and 7. So God's going to hold accountable all people for their speech. Of course, that does mean you and I need to be careful with speech. This is taking it from the standpoint you and I being attacked. In other words, like a Christian or believer. But when he closes this, he's somewhat in despair because there's no answer in the psalm. And what do you say, what is he in despair of? Because he lives among liars and those who like to stir strife, which is the opposite of what God's people are supposed to be like. Let me read it again in case you forgot. Notice what he says, woe is me. That's despair. That's what the language is. Woe is me, for I sojourn in Meshech, for I dwell among the tents of Kedar. Now, what is that? Now, I will tell you, I didn't know either because I couldn't remember, so I looked it up. Meshech, is a barbarous nation that existed far to the north. Okay? Kedar is a northern Arabian location where nomadic Ishmaelites were. So the idea here is very simply this. He feels as though he lives among liars and barbarians, people who are very aggressive. Can you relate to that? Maybe not as much on the other end, obviously, but I think our culture is pretty vile, isn't it, and violent today. And so that's what he's sort of describing. Again, this is poetic language, and so we can't stretch it too far. But these are the types of people that he felt he was surrounded by. No wonder he felt in distress. I mean, if you felt like you lived in a country or a nation or a group of people that were liars and ready to go to war at any sports turn of the hand here, it's no different to today, is it? I think even in the United States we have that, don't we? I mean, the United States has a lot of people that is just filled with lies. I don't even know what truth is anymore except for God's word. But we also have in our culture people that are just ready to go to war, literally, aren't they? And that is not what God's people are. Notice the ending of it, how this works, because it flips. Verse 6, too long my soul has had its dwelling with those who hate peace. This is the idea of what we just looked at, okay? But notice what God's people should be like. I am for peace. That's the description of what God's people are, so he's flipping it, if you notice. So he says, woe is me, I live in this awful area. People are always ready to go to war. They're always lying, slandering. They don't want peace. It's hard to make peace with people who don't want to, isn't it? I mean, you ever know, even if you think about in the military world, it's hard to make peace with countries that don't want peace. So they want to fight all the time. So this is the idea. But the Lord's people are supposed to desire peace. That is a description of God's people, not the aforementioned. And sometimes the aforementioned is what's described, I think, isn't it? We can be very much like that. I want us to look at two verses. And someone get 2 Corinthians 13:11, and I'll read the other one. And the other one is Matthew 5:9. Because my main thing would be for you to take away, if you get nothing else from this, you and I need to be peaceful people and seek after peace, not only because the Psalms say it, but Paul, and so does Jesus. And if Jesus says anything, we need to obey it. But Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, verse 9, he goes through this litany that describes blessed person. Remember verse 9? You do. I'm sure you've probably heard it. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Read it backwards. Sons of God are peacemakers, aren't they? Jesus didn't make anything too difficult for us. The question for you is, are you a peacemaker or do you like to stir the pot? We probably all stir the pot sometimes, don't we? But we're not supposed to. Someone read 2 Corinthians 13:11 for me.
Finally, brethren, rejoice. Be made complete. Be comforted. Be like-minded. Live in peace, and the God of love and peace will be with you.
Pretty much says that, doesn't it? We need to live in peace, and that's, of course, addressed to the church. And the church needs to be this way. I want to read you something here. It's from the Expositor's Bible Commentary, and he does a good job of this. It says, the godly have nothing in common with the wicked. The godly speak words of peace, whereas ungodly sow discord and adversity. Only the Lord can intervene in this situation, meaning the one of Psalm. And it's true probably in life in general. So, I was telling you before, these are written for the Israelites, for them to sing on the way up to Jerusalem for whatever the feasts are. But you and I can learn things from them too, can't we? We don't have to overread them, but I gave three. I'm going to give you these, and you may think of something else. We need to take our concerns to the Lord, knowing He will answer, which implies He hears. Two, the Lord will judge, in other words, make right, all evil, lies, slander, or one day. Have to wait and leave it to Him. And I think that's hard, isn't it? Then the third one, if you get nothing else, I implore you to take this one because I have seen the opposite too often. Christians are supposed to be known as peaceful people. Do I seek peace? Or do I like doing the stirring the pot?